7. September 26th, 10:03 p.m. Grant.
Where do Marshall girls hang out on a Friday night?
Kate. When you're friends with a future fashion designer, you find yourself in Dallas looking at fabric for hours. Why?
Grant. Damn, was hoping I could run into you.
Kate. I would have liked that a lot. The door to Rhino Coffee chimes when I push it open, and several people turn toward the entrance. The delicious aroma of coffee floats through the air. An indie rock station plays in the background. I'm in my happy place. Scanning the room, I see Reagan is already in our usual spot, but I stop at the counter first to place my order. I'm tempted to pull the, I'll have my usual, since we've been hanging out here every Wednesday night for years. But it would be devastating if the barista looked at me like she had no idea who I am. What can I get started for you? She asks with her usual smile. Large chai, please. I carry my steaming cup of goodness to the back corner and drop down on the big fluffy couch next to the chair Reagan's perched in. She is totally absorbed in her sketchbook and jumps about a foot when I tap her leg. Holy crap! You freaking scared me to death, she says. I laugh when I notice her brightly patterned outfit. I've never known Reagan to wear spandex before. Those pants are hot. She stretches her legs out. These are my new yoga clothes. Just finished a candlelight meditation class at Breathe Yoga. You didn't think I'd wear all black like everyone else, did you? No. God forbid you not stick out. Taking a peek at her pad, I revel in her artistic genius. At first glance, it looks like the dress she designed is two pieces, a cropped top and a flared short skirt. But it's an illusion. An intricate lace design covers the neck and shoulders, and it's somehow fun and sexy at the same time. Oh my God, Reagan, you have to make this and wear it to winter formal. Her face scrunches up. She's definitely her toughest critic. You think? Absolutely. Josh won't know what hit him. Reagan rolls her eyes. He probably won't even ask me. I shove her arm. Whatever, he totally will. And his eyes will pop out of his head when he sees you in this. Whose eyes are popping out? Alexis asks as she and Mignon drop down in a pair of chairs across from us. Josh's, when he sees her in the dress she's designing for winter formal, I answer. Mignon laughs. That means Josh would have to actually get up the courage to ask Reagan out first. Reagan slumps back in her chair. See? Seriously, that boy is killing me. What's the holdup? I mean, every chance he gets, he's by your side, Alexis says. He's scared she's going to shoot him down, I say. I've been watching him, and he's terrified. Mignon laughs, and Alexis says, You friend-zoned him too long. Reagan rolls her eyes. Well, we were friends first. I don't know what else I can do to let him know I'm into him. Maybe I'll just have to ask him out. Show me the dress, Mignon says. Reagan holds up her sketchbook and they both gush over her drawing. But my eyes are drawn back to the counter. Or rather, to who is at the counter. There are two girls placing their orders, and one of them is the girl who walked off the field with Grant after the Battle of the Paddle game. The girl his arm was around. The girl that should have been me. Who are you staring at? Reagan asks. Mignon and Alexis turn around to look. Then Mignon jumps up and runs to the counter. Does she know them? I ask, hoping to keep the horror I'm feeling out of my voice. Looks like it, Alexis says. Before I can form another sentence, she's dragging them back to our area. Oh, God, they're going to sit with us. Everyone, this is Rebecca Myers and her friend Lindsay. Rebecca and I played travel soccer together when we were younger, Mignon says, and then points to each of us, introducing us by name. Both girls say hi and sit on the couch next to me. Lindsay, the girl who was with Grant, is only inches away, and I'm finding it hard to breathe. Rebecca leans forward, looking at Reagan's sketchbook that's sitting on the coffee table,
This is hot. She looks up and asks, Did one of y'all draw this? Reagan gives a small little wave. I did. It's a design I'm working on. Lindsay takes a peek at the drawing. Do you just design or do you make them too? She's an all-around badass, Mignon says. From idea to finished product. Rebecca sits back. That's pretty cool. Do you sell any of your clothes? Reagan shakes her head. I wish. That would be 1,000 times better than working at the courthouse. Please, Alexis says. I would take your job over watching the Bradford triplets after school every day. Those parents are lucky their little monsters are still alive by 6 o'clock. Mignon pats her leg. Think of it as a good form of birth control. We all laugh, and the tension of sitting next to Lindsay lessens a little. You work at the courthouse? Rebecca asks Reagan. That sounds cool. The part I work in sucks. All I do is file all day. Kate's got a little more action where she is. She works for the prosecutor that got the River Point case. I cringe, and Lindsay chokes on her coffee. Reagan has no idea Grant was hanging out with Lindsay at the game the night before he was shot. Lindsay's face gets red, either from swallowing her coffee the wrong way or from the talk of Grant's case. She turns slightly away from me, refusing to look my way. Oh, God, Rebecca says, leaning forward so she can see me on the other side of Lindsay. Can you tell us what's going on? That's all anyone at St. Bart's can talk about right now. Lindsay ducks her head and crosses her arms in front of her. She's as uncomfortable talking about him as I am. I shrug and answer. Not really. We're just working through everything right now. There's not a lot to go on. Lindsay chews on her lip and drags in a deep, long breath before letting it out in a rush. Rebecca looks at her, sending her some sort of silent message, and Lindsay shakes her head slowly back and forth. I seem to be the only one who notices how weird they're acting.
It's so sad. His friends must feel terrible, Alexis says. I can't imagine if I accidentally hurt one of y'all. I know, right? Rebecca says. They were all so close. It's got to be tearing them apart.
Lindsay pops up from the couch. I'll be right back. I'll need to go to the restroom. And then she darts into the side hall.
Is she okay? Mignon asks.
Rebecca tilts her head to the side and shrugs one shoulder.
Yeah, she's fine. We were good friends with all of them. It's been hard on our entire school.
They were good friends. What if I totally got it wrong when I saw them together? What if it wasn't what I thought it was? What if I missed my last opportunity to be with Grant over unfounded jealousy? Even though I didn't think it was possible to feel worse than I already do, I was wrong. I'm still feeling down almost a day later, and stupid. I'm feeling sad and stupid. We're in the break room, eating a quick lunch before our shifts officially start, when Camille pops her head in. By the expression on her face, I can tell she's got some good gossip. Reagan kicks out the seat across from us with her foot and says, Sit and spill it.
You two owe me info, Camille says, plopping down in the chair. I'm not sharing until I hear something good from y'all.
Reagan and I share a look.
Fine, Reagan says.
Grant's dad showed up at Morrison's office yesterday afternoon. He's hired his own investigative team. Thinks we're a bunch of morons and doesn't trust any of us. He was asking for a copy of everything. Plus, he wants his guys to examine the evidence. I'm sure my mouth is hanging open.
Really? I ask, then nudge her in the side.
And I'm just now hearing this?
She shrugs.
I would have told you, but you've been sneaking out of here before me every night this week. Want to tell me where you've been going?
Reagan gives me a pointed look.
Touché.
Camille waves her hands in front of us, drawing our focus back to her.
So, what did Morrison say?
She doesn't know what to say. We've never had a case like this, ever, so we're all making it up as we go. She's told him to give her a few days and she'll figure it out.
This case really should have been sent to the Attorney General. The reason we could get the grand jury scheduled so quickly is because there's little else going on here.
I don't blame Mr. Perkins for bringing in experts from the outside.
Now it's your turn, Camille, and yours better be good, I say. Camille sits up a little straighter in the chair.
The Riverpoint dads met with Gaines this morning. All four of them. And then when they were leaving the office, that group of protesters showed up. You know, the ones who've been picketing in front of the building down the street.
Reagan and I nod. We have to pass them every day when we leave the courthouse.
Well, they must have spotted Mr. Flores when he came in, because they were waiting for him when he came out.
Why? I ask.
Because it's his construction company that's doing the work on that building. And they're blaming him for charging the city millions more than he should have, and they're blaming Gaines for not doing anything about it.
So what happened? Reagan asks.
Mr. Flores all but ran out of here, and Gaines ducked back in his office. Morrison had to boot the protesters out of here.
Even though Gaines is the DA, Morrison is really the one who runs this place. She's the backbone of this entire operation and runs her domain with an iron fist.
I can't help the sigh of disgust that escapes.
That's just like Gaines. Let this city go bankrupt before holding one of his friends accountable.
Reagan shifts uncomfortably.
Well, we don't really know the whole story.
Reagan is in the tricky position of being related to Gaines through marriage. She sees what happens up here, but she's loyal to her family, so she never outright criticizes him. I usually keep my mouth shut about him around her, but he's gotten so bad I can't help it. I crumple up my brown bag and stick it in the trash.
I'm heading up, I say.
Camille waves by, but Reagan just gives me a nod. I trudge up the stairs, exhausted from my restless sleep last night. I dreamed about Grant and his blonde, wavy hair and devilish smile. He was walking off that field, his arm wrapped around Lindsay. But instead of the football jersey he was wearing that night, he was dressed in camo, just like the boys were in the video interviews. And then he staggered back, the bullet tearing through his jacket and ripping his chest open. Lindsay was kneeling on the ground next to him, crying. A shudder runs through me, and I shake my head quickly to rid myself of the images. I relieve Mom so she can go get lunch, and I head into Mr. Stone's office. He's eating a chicken salad sandwich at his desk with his headphones on. I wonder if he's listening to the recordings Mom makes when she reads stuff for him, or if he's listening to the ones I've been making of the interrogation tapes. He pulls off the headphones when I move closer to his desk and presses stop on the player.
I'm here. Need me to do anything? I ask.
Before he can answer, there's a knock on the door. A short, balding man sticks his head inside Mr. Stone's office.
Yes, Mr. Stone says.
A man holds up a thick file folder.
Here's the coroner's report on the Riverpoint case.
Mr. Stone nods for him to put it on his desk and thanks him before he leaves. I can't help but think this is why the Riverpoint dads were in Gaines' office this morning. I bet they already have their own copy. He shoves the report into a messenger-style bag and throws the rest of his sandwich away.
Damn, I was hoping to get to this before I left for Riverpoint. I'll try to read the summary on the way while your mother drives.
Why are you going to Riverpoint?
I scheduled a visit to the scene. I need to get a feel for what happened that morning.
He can barely see across the room. What's he going to be able to see in the woods?
Mr. Stone seems to be looking for something on his desk and not doing a very good job.
I know what you're thinking, but your mother will be there to help me, he says.
I can't believe I'm about to offer this because it's the last thing on earth I want to do, the last place I want to be.
Would you like me to come? I can bring my camera. Take pictures of everything.
He stops and turns his head to the side so he can look at me.
This is a crime scene. A boy you know was killed there. Are you sure you're up for that? He asks.
I swallow hard and say, yes.
We remain there in tense silence for what seems like forever, until he finally asks,
"Do you have your camera with you?"
"Always."
"Grab your bag."
I gather my things and send a quick text to Reagan, while Stone tells Mom about the change in plans.
"I'm going to River Point with Stone, and I'm freaking out."
Freaking out is actually an understatement, because I'm not sure I can handle seeing where Grant died, even though I just promised I could.
Reagan, "You're going there? You're going to see where he died?"
Me,
"Yes, I'm not sure I can do this."
Reagan, "Just try not to puke or faint or anything like that. Call me when you're done." I drop my phone in my bag and take a few deep breaths before I follow Stone to the employee parking lot. I crank the car once he hands me the keys.
"Do you know how to get there?"
he asks. I nod. "Yes, sir, I think so." There have been maps of River Point on the news attached to almost every story they do. Everyone knows how to get there now. He settles back in his seat, pulling out the report that was just delivered to him. From the first glance, I can see the type is small, and there's no way he can read it on his own. Just before I'm about to put the car in reverse, he hands the report to me.
"Before we go, read me the top summary page, please."
I hate how sad his voice sounds. "Okay," I answer. There's a lot of technical jargon, words I can't pronounce, but by the time I finish, there's a big smile starting to form on his face.
"Okay, you're going to have to translate what I just read to you, because I have no idea what I just said."
Mr. Stone punches his fist in the air at a rapid pace. I don't know if I've ever witnessed this sort of excitement from him.
"I can do better than tell you. I can show you when we get there."
We're quiet for the rest of the drive, and I'm thankful his eyes are closed. My hands are shaking, and a thin layer of sweat pops out on my forehead. I want to help Stone any way I can, but I don't know how I'm going to make it through the afternoon. And whatever was in that report had him almost giddy. I'm trying really hard not to get my hopes up, but for the first time since we got this case, I'm feeling somewhat hopeful. I don't know what I expected, but I'm surprised by all of the cars when we pull through the gate at River Point. "Who are all of these people?" I ask. I park off to the side and wait while Mr. Stone gathers his stuff.
"That's the thing," he says. "We can be here, but so can everybody else. When I scheduled this visit, I was informed Mr. and Mrs. Forez insisted on being here, since it's their property. I believe the Carlyles will be here as well as Mr. Moore and Mr. McCullough. Even the boys were checked out of school to be here. Also, the defense's legal team is here, making sure they are aware of whatever we may discover. Grant Perkins's father requested to be here, so I also made sure there was a deputy on duty in case there was a problem. Also, Detective Pierce will be here to assist us and show us around the property."
The River Point boys are here. Maybe volunteering to come along wasn't that great of an idea. I swallow hard when I step out of the car.
"I didn't realize the police would let them all be here like this." Mr. Stone lets out a grunt.
"This isn't a closed crime scene anymore. All the forensic evidence has been taken, so it's not like they can mess anything up."
We walk slowly up the driveway toward the cabin. Although it's not a cabin. It's a mansion cabin. The place is made from rough-cut wood and is at least 2 stories tall, with huge glass windows on every side. Off to the left is a detached garage, where most of the bays are open, showing everything from all-terrain vehicles to jacked-up trucks to ski boats. This is definitely a sportsman's paradise. A crowd of men are gathered on the back porch, waiting for us. I hold my camera up in front of me like it's some sort of shield, and then I spot the group just inside the house. 4 of them, watching us from the big windows. The River Point boys. I take a slow breath in and then let it out. Mr. Stone puts a hand on my arm, stopping me.
"This is going to be difficult for me, as you know. take pictures of everything. Notice everything. It's probably for the best that you came here with me instead of your mother. I'm counting on you.
He's counting on me. I stand up straighter and pull my camera closer. I can do this.
They're all staring at us,
I whisper to Mr. Stone.
Flores and the others will try to intimidate us, make us rush, make us feel bad for being here. But we're going to ignore them. We have every right within the law to be here. We can stay as long as we need. We can look anywhere we want, take pictures, take measurements, whatever.
He answers with a wink. When we reach the back patio, everyone introduces themselves, and it's not hard to notice the divide. Mr. Perkins and his team on one side, with the four Riverpoint dads and defense lawyers on the other. And to think, these five men were close friends before this happened. Mr. Stone puts his briefcase on a stone table and pulls out some papers.
All right. We'd first like to see the spot where Grant was found.
My eyes cut to Mr. Perkins and he winces, the pain still fresh on his face. The deputy motions for us to follow him, and we move off of the flagstone patio into the woods. Everyone else follows close behind us, but thankfully the boys stay inside. I lift the camera to my face and start taking pictures. It's absolutely beautiful here. Giant trees dot the landscape, but with the limbs bare, sun filters in through the space. The ground is covered with leaves that crunch with every step we take. Most are dead, but some still cling to their bright orange and yellow colors. I'm surprised by how close to the house we are when we finally stop. There are little orange flags stuck in the ground and the rough shape of a body, and I know we've made it to the spot where Grant died. My jaw feels tight, and it's tough to swallow. Blinking back the tears, I drag in a deep breath, hoping to get myself under control. I can keep it together. For Grant. And what makes it worse is seeing Mr. Perkins. He started crying and has to lean against a nearby tree for support. In this moment, I really want nothing more than to stand with him, hug him, and cry as openly as he is. The others are quiet and keep their distance, uncomfortable with Mr. Perkins's display of emotions.
Kate, please start taking your photographs. I want pictures of the ground there.
He says and points to the flags, and a shot from every direction. Mr. Stone turns around to the crowd.
If you please, when my assistant turns in your direction, move out of her shot.
They nod, and I get to work. Hopefully, focusing on the task at hand will help me block out the total despair radiating from Mr. Perkins.
There are no wildlife cameras in this area? Mr. Stone asks.
The Riverpoint dads all look at each other and then to their lawyers. One of the lawyers answers for them.
I believe you have all of the pictures from any wildlife cameras.
I understand that. What I'm asking is if there is a wildlife camera in this area.
The lawyer just stares at Mr. Stone, clearly not giving him anything to work with or use against his clients later. Finally, Mr. Stone turns around and opens a file folder, but goes to great lengths to hide what he's reading. I move around in a tight circle, still snapping away.
Kate, Mr. Stone says quietly, please take a look at this.
I move next to him and peek inside the file folder. It's a color image of Grant, dead on the ground. My throat gets tight, and there's that funny feeling in my mouth that comes right before you puke. Turning away from the photo, I stare at the trees in the distance and try to push the sick feeling away. Deep breaths in, deep breaths out.
I'm sorry you have to see this, but I need your help in orienting me to the direction he was facing when he fell.
He whispers in my ear. I skim across the small type under the image, trying desperately not to look at Grant.
The report says he was facing northwest.
Mr. Stone nods, closes the folder, and repeats the direction to the officer, asking him to find that direction. It takes a few seconds for the officer to point us the right way.
Officer, the coroner's report states that
Based on ballistics, the shooter was 25 to 30 yards away. Stone hands him a tape measure from his pocket. Please measure 30 yards from this spot in that direction. I spin around to Mr. Stone and see that same smile he had in the car.
That's pretty close, I whisper.
He gives me a quick nod. The officer does as he's asked, and the only sounds are of the birds flying through the trees above us. I notice the investigators Mr. Perkins hired are taking their own pictures and scribbling in notebooks. The other group waits off to the side, but it's easy to see how tense they are. Once the officer is in place, I'm shocked. I could probably throw a rock and hit him from here. Even though Stone knew the shooter was close from the officers on the scene, it's different seeing just how close he really was.
Kate, stand next to me and take a picture in the direction of Officer Jones. Then go stand by Officer Jones and take a picture in my direction.
I do as I'm told, trying to forget about all of the eyes on me right now. My mind spins out of control when I focus in on the officer. There are no bushes or trees blocking the way. I can see him clearly. Wouldn't that mean the shooter saw Grant? We stay in that small part of the woods for over an hour, and by the time we head back to the cabin, I've taken nearly 500 pictures. The others walk ahead, but Mr. Perkins waits for us.
My wife and I have been searching for Grant's watch and class ring. They're not at home, and the Forrests say they're not here. We were given a list of Grant's things that were on him, but the watch and ring weren't listed. Have you seen any mention of those items anywhere?
Mr. Stone puts a hand on Mr. Perkins's shoulder.
I'm sorry, no. I haven't come across that, but I will keep an eye out for it.
You should fill out a report, though. At least you could file it on your insurance.
Mr. Perkins nods and says,
It's not the money I'm worried about. We just wanted his things back.
Mr. Perkins walks away, and Mr. Stone and I let him get a little ahead of us before we start back. I guess I always thought the one who shot Grant mistook him for a deer, I say quietly. But the shooter had to have seen him.
Of course he did. These boys were drunk and stupid. They were probably walking out to their stands, screwing around, and someone was clumsy with their gun. They were extremely negligent. That's why they're not giving up the one who pulled the trigger, because there's no way a jury would let them off.
I swallow hard. So it wasn't an accident? I ask. He slows down, increasing the space between us and everyone else.
That's where it gets tricky. Could this have been an accident? Yes. A stupid, senseless accident. Could it have been more than that? It very well may be.
Do you think he was murdered? I whisper. I can barely wrap my head around this. Stone stops.
There's only one thing separating negligent homicide from murder, and that's evidence of intent. We're still trying to figure which of them pulled the trigger. If we can't discover who did it, there's no way to know if there was intent. We have to take this one step at a time.
We start walking again, and just before we reach the others, Stone says,
I'm really proud of how you handled yourself out there.
I can't help but smile. Mr. Forrest moves toward us, gesturing to where our car is parked down the driveway, and says,
I'm sure you've gotten everything you need.
Mr. Stone shakes his head.
We'd like to inspect the inside.
Oh, God. Mr. Forrest consults with his defense team, and there is a quiet argument while Mr. Stone acts like he has all day. And, just as Mr. Stone called it, Mr. Forrest has to let us enter the house. I follow Mr. Stone inside, and he turns to the boys, who are standing near the kitchen area. I keep my eyes down because I'm scared to death to look at any of them right now. The disgust roiling around inside of me when I think about how they're protecting each other makes me sick.
Maybe you boys want to wait outside while we're in here, Stone says to them. I hear them shuffle out, but I don't move until it's quiet.
Kate, do your thing.
And I get to work. Mr. Stone and I move through every room while I take detailed pictures of every inch. Mr. Perkins and his investigators follow every step I take. I pass through a small den and recognize the couch where Shep was questioned, then the office where Logan sat near the desk. Moving through the house, there's the room where Henry sat nervously on his bar stool. Toward the end of the tour, I see the bedroom where John Michael was questioned. When we circle back to the main room, the sun has dropped farther down in the sky and the light has turned a fuzzy orange color. I zoom in close to a wooden board with a map stretched across it. There are nails sticking out in different areas across the map and small circular metal tags hanging from the nails. On each disc, there are names engraved. Grant, Henry, John Michael, Logan, and Shep. I take several pictures of the board before moving on.
We're done, Kate. You can head to the car while I say our goodbyes.
I can't get out of there fast enough. I exit through the front door while Mr. Stone goes to the back porch where everyone else is waiting. I'm just out of the door when I hear a voice.
Kate, can I talk to you?
And there is Shep, standing on the porch, watching me. No, I say, my voice full of disgust. I move down the front steps and hear him following behind.
I had no idea you would be here. I know how hard this is for you, but I need to talk to you.
I stop and throw a glance at the house, checking to see if Stone is witnessing this, but we're all alone out here. There is absolutely nothing you need to say to me, unless it is admitting to killing Grant, or telling me who did. His clenched fists hang by his side. I spin around, and just before I stomp off to Mr. Stone's car, he says,
I didn't shoot him.
A deep breath shudders out of me, but I don't turn around or move until I hear him walk away.
The second all the lawyers and that prosecutor and the girl with the camera left, they sit us down and start chewing our asses out. They'd known the one who shot Grant was near him, but no one was prepared for how damning it looked when the officer measured off the distance. It's time to stop all this bullshit and tell us which one of you pulled the trigger, one of the dads says. We'll stand by you. We'll use every resource available to make sure you don't go to jail, another one of the dads adds. My son wouldn't have done this, one of the moms says. The woman next to her spins around. And mine would? They're turning on each other. Maybe we should just get our own lawyers, one dad asks. Maybe we're better off individually. Oh, so you can make a deal on the side? Have your boy go in alone and rat the others out? The lawyers told us we're better off if we stick together. If the police can't pin this on one of them, it's not likely they can pin it on any of them, another dad says. The four of us sit on the couch, side by side, as a united front. These are the same arguments we made to each other in the parking lot of that abandoned store. These are the same things we fight about. It didn't change anything then, and it doesn't now. We have no choice. We made a pact in those woods. Either we all get out of this, or none of us does. We all know the consequences. It's as simple as that.
8. October 2nd, 10:03 p.m. Grant. Battle of the Paddle starts at 5. I can pick you up at 4. Kate. Oh no, I totally forgot. I have to take pics at the Science Bowl. I signed up for it weeks ago. Can I meet you at the party when I'm done? Grant. Yeah, that's fine. Kate. Sorry I won't see you play. Grant. It's cool. Thank God for Fridays during football season. Once the pep rally is over, Reagan and I will only have about 2 hours before we leave for work. It's a joke, really.
Reagan and Mignon sit on the bench against one wall of the gym, while I plop down next to Alexis on the floor in front of them. Reagan nudges me with her knee, and when I look back at her, she asks me in a quiet voice if I'm okay. She's asked me this 4 times already this morning. Yesterday was hard on me, and I can't exactly hide my bloodshot eyes or the dark circles under them, but I nod, giving her a tight smile. We're off to the side, ready to document, photograph, and basically ensure full coverage of the pep rally for the newspaper, website, and yearbook. The other 2 photographers are stationed on the other side of the room. I check my camera settings while we wait. Our football team is good, maybe even great. We make the playoffs every year, and most times win state. Our cheerleaders perform in Orlando on ESPN, and they had to build a new glass case for the trophies the dance line wins. So every pep rally is a show, especially this one since it falls on Halloween. But I can't get into it this morning. Mignon leans closer and says, "So Alexis and I want to do a piece for the newspaper on the River Point boys, and we need some pics of them to go with it. Maybe after the pep rally we can pull them aside and you can take them?" "I'm not supposed to talk to them," I say. "And I'm not sure I could if I wanted to. I'm having a hard time getting over the crime scene visit." Her face scrunches up. "So, don't talk. Just take a few pics." Reagan leans in close. "What are you going to ask them?" "I just have a few get-to-know-you kind of questions," Mignon says. Reagan leans back. "Boring. Ask them who pulled the trigger." "Have you even asked them for the interview?" I ask. Alexis smiles. "No, we're going for the ambush approach. That's why we need you ready." This is a bad idea on so many levels, but I find myself warming to the idea of witnessing this confrontation. What if she did ask them who pulled the trigger? If they were caught off guard, would their facial expressions give something away? As soon as that thought enters my head, the 4 of them appear in front of me, shoulder to shoulder, as they search for a place to sit. Minus the mandatory blazers with the crest on the pocket, they are still dressed as they would be for St. Bart's. And despite how they seemed to be falling apart in the parking lot next to Pat's, they are a united front here at school. If I hadn't witnessed them fighting, I would have never known there was a problem between them. Just like on the first day they arrived and the crowd parted for them in the hall, a space opens up on the bleachers, front and center. But the difference is, people aren't making room in an attempt to avoid them. In the week since they've been here, they've become something close to living legends. The horror of what they are accused of has morphed into this crazy fascination with them. "I'll come with you on the ambush, but there's no way they're going to talk to you," I say to Mignon. Alexis leans forward. "They will. We always get our story." The gym goes dark for a few seconds, and screams and cheers echo through the cavernous space. I can feel Alexis move past me as she gets up to film the dance line's opening. A black light pops on overhead, and there are 30 girls dressed in all black, with glow-in-the-dark stripes outlining their bodies, bent at odd angles. The blast of music makes us all jump, and within moments they start their routine. In keeping with the Halloween theme, they look more like skeletons than girls, and it's amazing to see their kicks and flips in perfect synchronization in the dark gym. Girls are flying through the air and tumbling across the room, and you can't help but be in awe of these performances. I turn away from the show and try to make out the 4 boys in the front row. They are easy to spot, since their white dress shirts are glowing in the blacklight, illuminating each of their faces. Shep and John Michael are spellbound by the show, but Henry and Logan have their heads bent in deep conversation. I analyze their every movement, look, and gesture, just like I do when watching their videos. I feel like I know them. Sitting at that desk at work, their voices coming through the headphones with everything else blocked away, I get sucked into their world. So now, here in the gym, I can tell Logan is saying something Henry doesn't like, because Henry's knee is bouncing, just like it did in the video. It's easy to see what no one else does. Studying them, I try to think about which one of them stood 30 yards away from Grant early that Sunday morning. Was the safety off? Did his finger slip and hit the trigger? Was he so drunk that he was waving his gun around in the air, being stupid? Or was it more than that? The routine ends to massive applause, and now that the overhead lights are on, I move through the gym, taking random candids of students while Juliana, the cheer captain, introduces the football team. When my camera lands on Shep, he's staring right at me. I'm zoomed in so close I actually jump back, startled by the directness of his stare. I pull the camera away from my face and study him without the camera between us. He doesn't look away, even though this is extremely awkward. Instead, he nods his head toward the far side of the gym. I glance back in that general direction, trying to figure out what he's gesturing to, but all that's back there is a door that leads to the hallway. I peek back at Shep, and he nods in that direction again, then points to his watch and holds up both hands with his fingers spread wide. What does that mean? Does he want me to meet him there? In 10 minutes? At 10 o'clock? What could he possibly have to say to me? As much as I want to blow him off like I did yesterday, that's the one thing that's been driving me nuts, wondering what he wanted to talk about. I turn away and sit down with my friends, trying hard not to panic. This could go spectacularly wrong. But what if I find out something that helps Grant's case? I have to risk it. Juliana jogs up to my side. We're ready. And then she looks at me closer. Are you okay? You look pale. A hand flies to my cheek as if I could actually feel the change in color. I'm fine. I follow her to the center of the gym, where the captain of the football team is standing with Coach Ford, who retired a few years ago. They are presenting him with a plaque for all his years of service to our school. I was so distracted by Shep, I completely forgot I was supposed to grab a picture. I rush up and snap a few shots. As soon as the pep rally is over, Mignon and Alexis make a beeline for the Riverpoint boys. Alexis glances back at me, urging me to follow them. By the time I reach them, Alexis has a small handheld recorder thrust in front of them, and Mignon is asking them questions. All four boys stare at them for a few seconds, then slowly turn my direction. All of them except Shep glare at my camera before looking at my face. It's hard not to flinch. Henry shakes his head, like he's disgusted by all three of us, before turning to walk away. Logan follows right behind him, then John Michael. Shep is the last to leave. My friends chase them halfway across the gym before finally giving up. Everyone files out of the gym, headed back to their homerooms, the Riverpoint boys no exception. I track their progress across the room, and just before they leave, Shep looks back at me. His eyes flicker to the same door he motioned to earlier, then he moves out of sight.
Transcript of the October 5th interrogation of Henry Carlyle by Detective Miller, with body language commentary by Kate Marino. Detective Miller. Seems like you've been able to get out of trouble easily in the past, but today is going to be different. Henry. There's no trouble for me to get out of. I didn't do anything, officer. Kate. Henry's on the stool, leaning back against the counter. He would look relaxed if it weren't for that leg that keeps bouncing. Detective Miller. It's Detective. Henry. So sorry, Detective. Detective Miller. So what's going to happen if Daddy can't get you out of trouble this time? Henry. Like I said, I didn't do anything wrong. Kate. Henry runs his hand through his hair. It's sticking up all over the place. Detective Miller. Something else interesting happened last night. A girl was brought into the ER just after midnight. She was unconscious, took something, but her friends didn't know what it was. They said she got it from you. That was one hell of a party. Did John Michael hook you up with something? I hear he's got everything you need out there. Kate. Henry shrugs, knee still bouncing.
Detective Miller. What did you give her? Henry. I have no idea what you're talking about. Kate. He's trying to come off cocky, but it falls flat. Detective Miller. I can arrest you for that alone and screw up your entire future. I bet you'd lose that shit-eating grin then. Henry. I guess you can try. Kate. Henry is sweating. If I can see it, the detective must see it. Detective Miller. I spoke to the girl's friend who brought her in. She was very eager to tell me about the party. Said there was fighting. Lots of fighting. She said your little group is falling apart. What do you think she means by that? Henry. I think it means she was drunk and doesn't know what in the hell she's talking about. Kate. Henry runs his hands over his forehead, then across his mouth. Detective Miller. So is that what you have to do to get girls? Get them high? Does it make it easier for you that way? Kate. Henry shakes his head, then rolls his eyes. Henry. No, I get plenty of girls on my own. Kate. Henry's hands are clenched around the edge of the counter. His face is red and a vein in his forehead is throbbing. Detective Miller. Maybe you were high this morning. Maybe when you're out of your gourd like that, poor Grant looks like a beautiful 10-point buck. Were you the one using the Remington? Kate. Henry tucks his lips between his teeth and shakes his head back and forth. Detective Miller. Or are you covering for one of them? When friends turn into secret keepers, they don't stay friends long. Unknown voice. Interview is over. Parents want a lawyer present. Kate. Henry pops up from the stool and disappears from the screen.
9. October 3rd, 11:17 p.m. Kate.
Is it crazy that I'm kind of nervous about seeing you tomorrow?
Grant. Is it crazy that I'm considering going to that science bowl so I can see you sooner?
It's been 50 minutes since Shep signaled me in the gym. We're both in English class, listening to Mr. Stevens drone on and on about the importance of MLA format, and Shep hasn't looked at me once. I'm starting to believe I imagined the entire thing. A shrill ping that always precedes an announcement from the office pierces through the room, and we all cringe.
Mr. Stevens, please send Mr. Shepard Moore to the office.
It's 10 minutes to 10. Shep started getting his books together before his name was announced, like he knew they were calling for him. Mr. Stevens motions for Shep to leave, and he heads to the door. Just before he exits the room, he throws a quick glance in my direction. My breath catches in my throat. He wants me to meet him at 10 o'clock. I didn't imagine it. The second hand of the clock above the whiteboard moves along at a swift pace while I try to decide what to do. I know Mr. Stone will be so disappointed in me if I meet Shep, with good reason, but my curiosity is winning out. With a minute to go, I slowly raise my hand.
Yes, Miss Marino?
Mr. Stevens asks.
May I be excused? I forgot I'm supposed to take pictures for the debate team. And now I'm lying.
The debate team is taking pictures, but Miranda is handling it, since she's got study hall this hour. Mr. Stevens lets out a deep huff.
You know I don't like you missing class for stuff like this.
I nod. I know. It won't happen again. I'm sorry.
I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm lying to my teacher. I'm going to meet one of the suspects in a case my boss is prosecuting. I'm going to be in a huge pile of trouble if I get caught.
I head to the gym, texting Reagan while I walk.
FYI, I'm meeting Shep Moore in the back hallway behind the gym. At least someone will know where I am and who I'm with. God, I'm acting like he's going to kill me and dump my body in some remote location.
My footsteps echo across the empty room, and my pulse starts to race the closer I get to the back door.
I can't believe I'm doing this.
With my hand on the door's bar, I take a deep breath before I push my way through. Shep is waiting there, exactly like I knew he would be. We watch each other a moment, the silence heavy between us. His forehead scrunches as he stares at me. Then he lifts his phone, tapping the screen. My paranoid brain rushes to the first possibility. He's taken a video. I start to back away. I can't get caught here with him like this. I can't be on some recording that will be produced later and get me in a world of trouble. And then my phone buzzes in my back pocket, scaring me to death and making me jump. It's probably Reagan texting me back. I pull it out, and my heart drops. The notification on the front screen reads, Grant Perkins, now. iMessage. Slide to reply. Words I've prayed to see but never thought were possible flash in front of me. How is this happening? This can't have come from Grant's phone. Grant's phone is locked up in Stone's desk at work. I've seen it. I've been trying to get my hands on it for 2 days. My hand shakes when I swipe the message open. This is Shep. You've been talking to me this entire time, not Grant. I look at Shep. This can't be possible. There's no way this is possible. My eyes drop back to my phone. I read the message again before my eyes move to the previous message above it. I'm sorry. Give me a chance to explain. Grant's last message to me.
Not Grant.
Shep. My eyes go to his once more, and the truth is there. No. This is all wrong. This is not happening. I turn back to the door, pulling it open so roughly it bangs against the wall. I feel gutted. For a second, I thought it was possible Grant wasn't really gone. There had been some big mistake. He was somewhere texting me, somewhere alive. The tears roll down my face as I sprint through the gym, away from Shep. I can't even process what he just told me. How could I have been talking to him this whole time and not have known? Everything in my brain rejects this. I reject this. I think back to when I first met Grant. I was at the library studying. Shep was with him. They were sitting down the table from me, being loud, disturbing everyone around us. I asked them to be quiet. Neither one of them would have noticed me if I hadn't spoken to them first. Grant scooted down until he was right in front of me, and Shep followed along. We all talked for a while, more quietly than before. I knew who they were, had heard their names, but I'd never seen them in person or spoken to any of the boys from St. Bart's. Grant carried the conversation that day at the library, and just like everyone has said, he was utterly charming to be around. Funny and sarcastic, and telling stories that had me blushing. Shep was quieter, listening and watching more than talking. When I was just about to leave, Grant grabbed my phone, and I remember my heart racing when he added his number to my contacts. He even looked at Shep and laughed, saying, I guess I'll give her yours, too. He sent a text to both of their phones, from mine, to make sure they had my number, too. They left shortly after, and I was giddy, flying. When Grant texted me later that night, I was beyond excited. Shep texted me a few days later, but it was clear he was just looking for a hookup. I hear footsteps behind me.
Wait, Kate, please let me explain.
I ignore him and keep running. I make it to the far side of the gym before Shep catches up with me. I whirl around and hold out my hand. He stops. His gaze is soft. Hopeful, even. I look at him. Really look at him. This can't be true. This is a trick. This isn't real. Twisting back around, I race through the door.
Everywhere we go, we are asked questions. Our parents ask us questions. The lawyers ask us questions. Who used the Remington? Where were you hunting? Why do you have to be such a fuck-up? None of us talk about what will happen after. After the grand jury? After everyone stops asking us these ridiculous questions? Maybe they'll never stop asking us. Standing together like we are to protect each other should make us stronger. It should make us closer. But it doesn't. Our silence is ripping us apart. There will be time to put things back together once this is over. We will be closer than ever. We will be like brothers again. We will not always be the River Point boys.
10. September 19th, 8:57 p.m. Grant, I mean Shep.
I'm at a party at River Point. The guys are pissed at me.
Kate, why are they pissed? Grant,
I mean Shep. Because I'd rather be sitting in the back room texting you than hanging out with them.
I don't go back to class. I don't go to the media arts room. And I certainly don't go to work. I need time alone, to think, to sort all of this out in my brain. But every time I think about Shep, I remember those disgusting texts he sent, and my stomach turns. But that wasn't him, I remind myself. It was Grant. My mind is about to explode. Since Mom and Mr. Stone have been spending most waking hours at work, she's relieved his normal driver and taken over that duty herself, leaving me with her Honda. I've never been so happy to have a car in the parking lot as I am this morning. I'm only ditching one class, and that shouldn't throw up too many red flags, especially with everything going on today. My teachers just assume when any of us are missing, we're off doing stuff for the media arts department. My phone buzzes again, and I'm scared it's Shep. I glance at it as I slide into Mom's car. It's Reagan.
Just seeing this? What in the hell are you doing? Do I need to come rescue you?
I reply, I'm fine. Leaving school early. I'll see you at work later. It only takes a few seconds for her to reply.
Is this code for something? I'm not sure if you're really asking for help.
I can't help but laugh. I text her I'm fine and throw my phone across the seat. I drive around aimlessly, trying to let my mind go. I roll the windows down and crank up the radio, hoping that if I can't hear myself think, my brain will shut off. It helps for a little while. Without consciously being aware of where I was going, I find myself at Columbia Park, my go-to place for downtime. I've taken some of my best pictures here. It's empty this time of day, since the bigger kids are in school and the younger ones are probably inside having an early lunch right now. I drop down on one of the benches under the big oak tree near the swing set and pull out my phone, scrolling through my messages until I find Grant's name. But it's not Grant. It's Shep. I try to reread the messages I thought were from Grant and picture Shep's face in my mind, but it's hard to do. I don't get too far back before I have to stop. It's too painful. Dropping my phone, I bury my head in my hands and cry. It's like finding out Grant's dead all over again, but this time it's the Grant that I was falling for, the one in my heart and in my mind. I hear heavy footsteps behind me, and I spin around quickly, almost falling off the bench. It's Shep.
Did you follow me here? I ask wildly. I drove around for at least 20 minutes before winding my way back here.
He shakes his head. No, I just figured you were here. I can't stop the eye roll. You just thought I would be at this tiny little park in a part of town you've probably never been to before. He moves a little closer.
You've talked about this park. A lot. Talked about this oak tree. Described the pictures you took here.
My breath catches.
This isn't real. This can't be happening. Shep wouldn't know about this park. He couldn't know. I told Grant about this place. But it wasn't Grant. I feel sick.
He moves even closer, just steps away from the bench.
Please, give me a chance to explain, he says in a quiet voice. The same exact words Grant said in his last text to me. No, Shep.
I don't understand, I say, then drop my head against the back of the bench.
I think back to that first time I met them, trying to make sense of everything. Grant put y'all's number in my phone. Did he switch them? Why would he switch them?
Shep lets out a deep breath and sits on the ground, his arms rested on his pulled-up knees.
When you got up to go return that book, I told Grant I thought you were cute. Told him I was going to ask you for your number. He beat me to it, but I was glad he at least gave you my number, too. He switched them and put my number under his name and his number under mine. It was his idea of a joke. I swear, I didn't know.
He leans his head back.
He was always doing stupid shit like that.
I didn't think I could feel any worse, but I do. I'm humiliated and confused and heartbroken and furious.
At some point, you must have figured it out,
I say through gritted teeth.
He nods. The day of the Battle of the Paddle, you sent that picture of Grant and Lindsay, and you were so mad at me, and I couldn't figure out why. Why would you send that pic to me?
So I asked Grant, and he almost pissed himself he was laughing so hard. He had no idea we had been texting for those few weeks. That's when I found out what he'd done. I sent you that last text, hoping you would let me explain.
I jump up from the bench and start pacing around.
So for weeks, I was talking to you, not Grant.
It's not really a question, but Shep answers it anyway.
Yes, it was always me.
It's like I'm being split in two. The half of me that fell for Grant over late-night conversations and has mourned his death every day battles the other half, who is looking at this stranger, who may also be a killer, and realizing he's not a stranger at all.
I just don't know how it's possible that I didn't know it was you instead of Grant, that you didn't know I didn't know. I can't believe this.
He stands up and moves toward me. I've thought about it for a while. I've read back through all of our texts. It's not like I signed my messages from Shep. We were strangers. We got to know each other through those messages. You had no reason to think I wasn't Grant. I had no reason to think you didn't know it wasn't me.
He inches closer. And everything I said to you, I meant. I still do.
I push away from him. My brain is in overload, trying to reconcile what I've heard and what I already know.
Then why have you waited so long to tell me?
I scream at him.
You knew I thought I was talking to Grant, and he died. I've been out of my mind regretting that last text, regretting that he died believing I was mad at him.
The tears race down my cheeks, and his hand brushes them away before I can stop him.
Kate, I've been in a pretty bad place.
His voice is raw.
One of my best friends is dead, killed by one of my other best friends. I'm being questioned. We're all being questioned. I may go to jail for this. My parents are furious and scared, and basically, my life is a nightmare right now. I just thought it would be better to let you go. You didn't need to be a part of any of this.
A step closer to him, pained by the expression on his face and the hurt in his voice.
So why tell me now? I ask.
He swallows.
I miss talking to you, Kate. There are so few people I can talk to right now. I didn't know how hard it would be seeing you every day. I feel like I know you, like there was something between us. But when you look at me, I'm a stranger to you. It kills me.
His head lowers. We are just inches apart. My eyes scan his face, memorizing it so I can try to match what I was feeling in those conversations to the person in front of me. Grant's name screams through my head, but it's not the same Grant I knew 5 minutes ago. It's all so fuzzy.
So the texts I got that I thought were from you were actually from him?
I ask. He nods, his jaw clenching, just like it does in his interrogation videos.
Why am I in his phone under the initials FWS? Do you know? His head cocks to the side, like he's trying to figure out a puzzle. I can tell the instant he gets it.
I can also tell he doesn't want to tell me what it stands for.
Tell me, please, I beg. Finally, he says,
It stands for fuck with Shep. That's what he said when I asked him about you. He said, Operation Fuck with Shep worked out after all. It was all a game to him.
I drop back down on the bench. It was a game. I can't do this. Not with you. Not right now, I whisper.
He kneels in front of me. I know you, and deep down you know me too. You just know me by the wrong name.
I hug my arms tight around my body as if I can stop myself from shattering into a million pieces. When I see you, I remember those messages I thought were from you. They were disgusting. Why would Grant say those things?
Shep visibly cringes. Can I read them? His messages?
Squeezing my phone tightly, I try to think of any reason not to hand it over, but I've got nothing. I scroll to his messages and give my phone to Shep. He must read through them more than once, because it takes a while for him to hand it back. Please switch our names. I hate seeing those messages with my name at the top of the screen. I do as he asks.
Why did he do this? I ask again.
Grant's sense of humor was twisted. He knew I was going to text you. He knew I was interested. He knew, at least at first, you would think I was him. And then if you got some shitty messages you thought were from me, well, that would make it even better. He was always screwing with people like that.
But people loved him. Everyone I've talked to loved him. This doesn't make sense.
People were amused by him. He was fun and entertaining until you found yourself on the wrong side of his jokes.
Shep sits down on the other end of the bench, keeping a safe distance between us.
I'm so sorry, Kate. You have no idea how sorry I am that you've had to go through this.
He reaches out for me, but I shrug away. The sadness on his face shatters me. Everything about this shatters me.
I'll work for the prosecutor who's handling your case.
I scoot even farther away to put some distance between us.
I'm glad you told me, but it doesn't change anything. I can't talk to you or be seen with you.
His head drops.
I know. I probably shouldn't have told you. I thought maybe if you knew the truth, you wouldn't be sad anymore.
I jump up from the bench, white-hot anger suffocating me from out of nowhere.
Seriously? I've been mourning Grant for weeks now. It's not like a switch I can flip on and off.
I spin around and move toward the swings, shoving one so it sways violently back and forth.
And then there's you. You're sitting there telling me you know me, expecting me to be okay with this.
Shep moves behind me. His hands are gentle on my shoulders. My heart is pounding. There is a desperate part of me that wants to step back into him, this stranger who is not a stranger. But I can't.
I step away from him, and his hands fall away. Without turning around, I ask, Were you the one who shot Grant?
His breath lets out in a loud rush.
No. I told you the truth yesterday. I've never lied to you. Not when we were texting, and not now. I swear, I didn't shoot him. If there's only one thing you will believe, please believe that.
His voice cracks, and I can't help but turn around. I look at him like I've never looked at him before. I study his face, his brown eyes that are begging me to see him for who he really is, and his tense expression that shows me that this is as hard for him as it is for me.
But you're covering for the person who did. That's almost as bad, I cry. My hands are shaking.
He shakes his head.
No, I'm not, he says in a quiet voice. I don't know who did it.
We all stood over his body, and no one would admit to shooting him. No one would admit to using that gun. But I swear to you, it wasn't me. Please believe me.
It's hard to swallow for the lump in my throat. I search his face, seeking some sign he's lying. I know him, but I don't. I know the person on the other end of those messages. That person I would believe. But is that the same person in front of me right now?
I'm sorry. I can't do this. I can't be here. Kate?
Shep says, like a question, but I shake my head and turn away. When I get in my car and pull out of the parking lot, he's still there, sitting on my favorite bench under the big oak tree. I'm only a few minutes late to work. Mom is in the office with Mr. Stone, so I drop down in her chair, giving myself a few more minutes to come to grips with what I've learned. As I scan the mess on top of her desk, a half-buried piece of paper catches my eye when I see a number circled in red ink. I pull it out of the pile, making sure I don't disturb anything else, and written next to the number is a date, October 5th, and the name Lindsay Wells, the girl Grant was with the night before at the Battle of the Paddle game, the same girl who acted really weird at Rhino Coffee the other night when we started talking about the River Point boys. October 5th. This is the call he deleted from his phone the morning he died.
Kate, you're here, she says,
and her eyes go to the paper I'm holding. Looks like you figured out who Booty Call 3 is, I say, keeping my voice even.
Yes, but she wasn't any help.
She said she had been with Grant the night before, but they had gotten in a fight. Apparently he called her that morning, trying to make up with her, and she blew him off. Probably why he deleted the call.
Poor dear was so upset.
Couldn't stop crying. I get up from her seat while she puts the papers back in a folder.
And don't go running off and telling Reagan what I just told you. You know how that girl loves to gossip.
I nod, not even trying to defend Reagan, since it wouldn't do any good. Mom's face is full of concern when she finally looks at me.
You look like you've been crying. Are you okay?
I rub a hand across my face. I'm fine. She stares at me a moment, but doesn't push it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to step out for some lunch. Mr. Stone is on a conference call right now, but should be done shortly.
Mom points to the area off to the side of her desk.
He's got an interview queued up, ready for you. Do you want me to bring you back anything?
I shake my head, unable to answer, because at my little corner desk, Shep's face is frozen on the screen, waiting for me.
Okay, I'll see you in a few, she says,
just before stepping out of the door. She leaves the office, and I slowly make my way to the table. All I can focus on is Shep's face. He looks different on the screen than he did a few minutes ago in the park. Here, his face is set in stone, no trace of any emotion. Not like at the park, when he was a breath away from falling apart. I sit at the table and put the headphones on. This is going to be the hardest one I've done, now that I know who he really is. I take a deep breath and brace myself. Then I press play.